From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross.
Yeah, hi. My name is Larry David, and I used to be the executive producer on The Seinfeld Show.
Today, Larry David talks about his shows Seinfeld and Curb Your Enthusiasm and his new Broadway play, Fish in the Dark, which he stars in.
First of all, it's a lot of pressure.
You got to make 1,000 people laugh every night with a script. It's not like doing stand-up. It's not so easy.
Also, we'll meet the husband and wife team who created High Maintenance, the award-winning web series about a New York pot dealer and his clients. And we talk with writer Chris Avett. His forthcoming memoir is about how his father supported the family by writing pornography.
Ghosts, zombie porn, porn set in Atlantis, porn on alien planets with barbarian cultures, vampire porn, pirates.
That's coming up.
Porn in New York City, porns of the Old West.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our guest Larry David co-created Seinfeld and created the HBO comedy series Curb Your Enthusiasm, in which he starred as a selfish, self-absorbed, misanthropic character named Larry David. The real Larry David is pretty popular in New York right now. He wrote and stars in a new play which opened this week and broke Broadway's all-time record for advance ticket sales. The play's called Fish in the Dark, and it's a comedy about the rivalries and dysfunction of a family as its patriarch passes away. I began my interview with Larry David by playing a recording from a preview performance of the play. The scene is set at a family gathering after the father has died. The dead man's widow, played by Jane Houdyshell, is startled by something she's seen. We also hear her two sons, played by Ben Shankman and Larry David.
Cindy!
Calm down. What is it?
It's a bird out there. You didn't see it? It was right there.
So what?
It was an Oriole. Daddy was from Baltimore. He was an Oriole fan. That was a sign from Sydney. He said he would give me a sign, and that was it.
Mama, you're crazy? They'll put you in the nut house. Just a bird.
It wasn't a bird. It was Sydney.
So I don't understand. What if it was Dad? Is that a good thing? Dad's a bird? Dad's a bird. It's a bird. It's a plane. It's Sydney. What a freak show.
Well, Larry David, welcome to Fresh Air. You play the lead in the play, and I gather that was not your intent originally, right?
Don't remind me.
So how did you thought of someone else at the role? Anybody in particular?
Anyone in particular. Anyone except me. Uh-huh. I got roped in. The producer, Scott Rudin, said, "This sounds like you. You have to do this." And, of course, it did sound like me, the main character. So I don't know. I thought, well, I wonder what that'll be like to do something like this. And now I know. Yeah. Now
yeah.
I know.
Yeah, and?
It's not so easy, Dave. It's not so easy.
No, well, it certainly doesn't look easy to me. And you had not been on stage since you were a kid, right?
Yeah.
So what was hard about it?
First of all, it's a lot of pressure. And you got to make 1,000 people laugh every night with a script. It's not like doing stand-up. It's just something. It was something new for me. I never did it before, and it's definitely a challenge.
You know, people talk about taking themselves out of their comfort zone for a new challenge.
Yeah.
Was it that kind of thing for you? Because it sounds like you sure did.
Yeah, if you even have a comfort zone. Whatever comfort zone I had was pretty narrow. But this was definitely out of it for sure. Yeah.
You know, in Curb Your Enthusiasm, as I understand it, most of the dialogue was pretty much improvised. You would give all the actors an outline and then you'd improvise it. This must be very different working from a script. Was that hard?
Yeah, it is different. It's completely different. I have total freedom on Curb to kind of say and do anything I want. I can follow every impulse that I have, and I'm allowed to interject when other people are talking. I'm kind of writing the scene as we're doing it, but this play is a different animal. You have lines, there are cues that are very important. The whole, if you just screw up online, you're off track and it's hard to get back on. You have to abide by the script. And the other actors don't like it if you get off of it either.
Right. They're counting on the cues and your timing.
Yeah. By the way, so am I. I'll be completely thrown.
You know, when you were doing Curb Your Enthusiasm, so much of the comedy came from the facial expressions, which you got in close-ups. I mean, this is a completely different kind of animal. Just talk a little bit about that. Is it a matter of giving the same kind of expression in a broader, more physical way?
Are you saying I'm too broad, Dave?
No.
Is that what I'm getting here?
I'm asking you to talk about your art.
you know what? I haven't really changed a lot of my so-called technique, even though there are, as you said, no close-ups or anything like that. I'm making the same stupid faces that I would normally make. Probably. I could tell when I get reactions from a glance or, just some kind of reaction that I'm making. I know when the audience is amused by it.
There are a lot of really veteran theater actors in the cast. I mean, some really great performers. And
yes, it's a great cast.
It is. And I wonder if there are things about just theater culture that you've noticed and been surprised or intimidated or anything by.
Well, there are some superstitions they have. Like, you're not allowed to whistle in the theater. And, of course, I've whistled a number of times because I'm an inveterate whistler. And I just always seem to forget. And boy, oh boy, do I get some bad looks when I do that. From some of the vets, they don't like that one bit.
We're speaking with Larry David. He wrote and stars in the new Broadway play Fish in the Dark. As I read about, your early life, one of the things that occurred to me is that, I grew up in a family. My parents didn't go to college. None of the people in my neighborhood went to college. And, I kind of managed to make a career and get on the radio, and I've been lucky enough to, do the show from time to time and talk to people like you. But there's still a part of me that kind of doesn't believe in it. And people that I know that grew up in families where they were wealthy or their parents were public figures or university professors, they're just more comfortable out in the world and accepting that they are somebody. And I wonder, even after all you've accomplished, do you feel like you belong on the red carpet and, in magazines?
Not really. I completely understand what you're saying. It is a little odd. I'm somewhat detached from it. Like I'll see my name on the marquee and it doesn't really kind of register in any way. So I'm disassociated from it. But occasionally I do feel like a jerk. What am I doing here walking on the red carpet? These people obviously don't know me.
How did you get into comedy? You said you were in college having fun, no thought of a particular future.
Yeah, then I got out of college and I was funny with my friends, and my friend's wife said to me, you should be a comedian. And I thought, really? That hadn't occurred to me. And then I went to the improvisation, to watch a show. And as I'm watching the show, I'm starting to think that, hey, maybe Jane's right. Maybe I could do this. In fact, not only am I starting to think I could do it, I think I could be really funny up there. Not only that, I'm going to go up there right now. I go up to the owner of the club, Bud Friedman, and I say, I'd like to go on. Now, I'm just sitting in the audience on a Saturday night. I leave my seat, and I go talk to the owner, and I say to the owner of the club that I want to go on. And this is probably the most insane thing I've ever done in my life. And he said to me, "Who are you?" I said, I'm just sitting in the audience. He said, "No, you can't go on. Are you a comedian?" I said, "No." He said, No, you have to audition, and then if you pass the audition, then you could start going on." So thank God he said no, because had he said yes and I had gone up, it would have been a disaster. I may never walked up on a stage again for the rest of my life. But I started to put an act together, and then I went down to the village to a place called Gertie's Folk City, and I did. I got on stage for the first time. A week later, I went to Gil Hodges' bowling alley in Brooklyn and got on stage for the second time. And then for the third time, I went to Catch a Rising Star, and I passed the audition, and then I started working out at Catch a Rising Star.
You became friends with Jerry Seinfeld doing stand-up together, and the two of you conceived of this incredible hit TV show, Seinfeld. And, of course, everybody knows the four characters, and that George Costanza is, I guess, somewhat based on you. Did you ever consider playing that role yourself?
No. It was never mentioned. I never thought of it. Jerry never thought of it. Furthest thing from my mind. And by the way, I couldn't have done it anyway. I mean, I had a 24/7 job just on the writing end of it and the producing end. So there's no way I could have been in it.
I wonder if you could share a bit of how you talked to Jason Alexander about the character and the role and how you felt about what he did with it.
First of all, I never even spoke to him about it. We auditioned a number of people to play George, hadn't really found anyone. And then this tape was sent in from New York, and Jerry and I watched the tape, and it was Jason auditioning in New York with a casting director, reading with a casting director, just sitting on a stool. I heard 10 seconds, and I went, oh, boy. There he is, this guy, this is the guy. And I never had to say one word to him about the character or anything like that. He just had it right from the beginning. He was great. What a fantastic actor. Gave me so many laughs watching him do that.
We're going to play a clip from Seinfeld, and there's a million we could choose, but I thought we would do one of Big Stein, George Steinberg.
Okay.
And, of course, people who know the show will know that there were many episodes where George Costanza worked for the New York Yankees, and he would be occasionally summoned to the office of the famous owner, George Steinbrenner, and you would do the voice. It would be shot from behind another actor, so you didn't actually see him. And this is an episode, I think, in which Steinbrenner has summoned George because he's heard rumors about George's political views.
You wanted to see me, Mr. Steinbrenner?
Yes, George, I did. Come in. George, the word around the office is that you're a communist.
A communist? I am a Yankee, sir, first and foremost.
You know, George, it struck me today that a communist pipeline into the vast reservoir of Cuban baseball talent could be the greatest thing ever to happen to this organization.
Sir?
You could be invaluable to this franchise. George, there's a southpaw down there nobody's been able to get a look at. Something Rodriguez. I don't really know his name. You get yourself down to Havana right away.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Do my best.
Good. Merry Christmas, George. And bring me back some of those cigars in the cedar boxes. You know, the ones with the fancy rings? I love those fancy rings. They kind of distract you while you're smoking. The red and yellow are nice. It looks good against the brown of the cigar. The Maduro, I like the Maduro wrapper. The darker, the better. That's what I say. Of course, the Claro's good, too. That's more of a pale brown, almost like a milky coffee. I find the ring size very confusing. They have it in centimeters.
And George Costanza has wandered out of the room. That's our guest, Larry David, as the voice of George Steinbrenner. It's funny, as we listen to that, it's not quite your speaking voice. You did some stuff there with that.
Well, hey, you know, Dave, I was doing an impression.
You're an actor.
Oh, sure. No, we brought in some people to read for Mr. Steinbrenner, and nobody really got it. And Jerry said, "Well, what are you looking for? How does it go?" And all of a sudden, I started talking like this. You know, he's a big blustery guy. He kind of talks like that. And Jerry said, "Yeah, you should do it. That's funny." So that's how that happened.
Uh-huh. Did you ever hear how Steinbrenner himself reacted to the bit?
I think he liked it. Steinbrenner was unfamiliar with the show. His grandchildren watched it, and his grandchildren talked him into letting us use his name. The last episode, I think, of the 96 season, we came up with the idea to actually fly him in and put him on the show. Because up to that point, we'd only been seeing the back of his head, and I was doing his voice. And then we thought it would be fun if he actually made a real appearance. So we called him up, and he said, yeah, he would do it. So we flew out to do it. He did the show. We started editing the show, and as I watched it, I'm going, oh my God, this is not good. And we thought it's so much better to just see the back of his head with me doing the voice than to actually see the real Steinbrenner, because his acting was wanting, to say the least. So I had to call him up and tell him the news that he was being cut from the show. So I called Yankee Stadium and I asked to talk to him. And then he got on the phone. I said, Mr. Steinbrenner, this is Larry David calling from the Seinfeld show. And he said, yes, Larry, what's going on? I said, well, Mr. Steinbrenner, I watched the show. And he said, yeah, you can tell me. I'm a big boy. I said, well, it's not working. We have to cut you from the show. And he was actually okay with it.
Let's talk a bit about Curb Your Enthusiasm. And I want to begin with a clip. In this case, you're walking down the street in Los Angeles and spot your old friend Marty Funkhauser, who's played by Bob Einstein, and his mother has recently died. Let's listen.
Hey! Funkhauser!
My God, I can't believe it. You're out? What are you doing?
This helps my emotions. Jogging is the best thing for me.
So mourners exercise. I didn't know that.
I don't know if mourners exercise. It's just good for me.
Interesting. I'm going to remember that next time I lose a close member of my family.
Yeah. Jogging.
Yeah.
Helps everything.
By the way, I called your house. I left a condolence message. I never got a return call.
Well, I had a few things on my mind.
Yeah, still. It's a little discourteous.
Let me explain something to you.
Sure.
I lost my dad a year ago. My mother just died. I'm an orphan, okay?
You're what?
I'm an orphan.
Orphan?
Yeah, an orphan.
You're a little too old to be an orphan.
No, if you don't have parents, you're an orphan.
Oh, you could be 70 and be
you
an orphan?
You could be 100 and be an orphan.
Oh, you can't be 100 and be an orphan.
Yeah, you can.
Okay, little orphan Funkhauser.
That's our guest Larry David and Bob Einstein on Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yes, I'm upset. Because he didn't respond to my call. He never returned my call.
A little discourteous.
I thought it was discourteous.
Larry David wrote and stars in the new Broadway play Fish in the Dark. You'll find a longer version of our conversation online at freshair.npr.org. Coming up, we meet the husband and wife team behind the web series High Maintenance. This is Fresh Air Weekend. There are more and more ways for the creators of TV shows to bypass the TV networks these days, like creating a web series. The web series High Maintenance was named Best Web Series of 2014 by LA Weekly. Last month, the series won the Writers Guild of America Award for Short Form New Media. High Maintenance was co-created by our guests, Katya Blickfield and Ben Sinclair, in 2012. Sinclair stars as a pot dealer, known only as The Guy, who rides his bike around Brooklyn delivering to an assortment of clients. But it's not a stoner comedy. Each episode, which ranges from around 5 to 20 minutes, is more like a funny and sometimes poignant character study of the clients and why they get high. Blickfield and Sinclair, who are married, used their own money to create the series and shot on location in the apartments of friends as well as in their own. The early episodes of High Maintenance are available for free, but last year the video sharing website Vimeo made High Maintenance its first original series, which means they started funding the series and charging a small fee for the episodes. Katya Blickfield is an Emmy Award-winning casting director who worked on the TV show 30 Rock. Ben Sinclair is an actor and editor. Fresh Air producer Anne-Marie Baldonado spoke to Blickfield and Sinclair. They started with a clip from an early episode of the series. It begins with a couple making dinner when they realize a mouse is caught in a glue trap in their kitchen. They freak out, order some pot from their guy, and when he arrives, they're still obsessing about the mouse.
We're so stressed out. There's a mouse.
Oh, well, just set a trap, guys.
That's the problem. There is a trap, and it's a glue trap, and the mouse is stuck in it, and it's screaming, and it's very clearly suffering, and we don't know what to do.
You just kill it.
No, it's inhumane.
Well, it's not actually inhumane. I mean, we caught a mouse in a glue trap, and we didn't see it till a couple hours later, and it had chewed its leg off like James Franco in that rock climbing movie, and it dragged itself off and expired in the dog dish. So it's like, it might be more humane to kill it.
No, this is not an apartment where things die. This is an apartment where things live. We do not torture in this apartment, and we do not kill.
I mean, to be fair, we already gassed it, and it's, like, totally covered in Pam.
Sounds like torture.
Yeah, to me. I mean, it's doused in Pam, so I think maybe we should just kill it.
Okay, fine. Will you do it?
Yes, I will do it.
That's a scene from the series High Maintenance. Katya Blickfeld and Ben Sinclair, welcome to Fresh Air.
Yes, thank you for having us.
Why were you interested in making the series about a pot dealer? What access did you feel like the pot dealer offered you into characters?
It's really just that the pot dealer can get inside of somebody's apartment and then kind of engage in this activity that's illegal that both him and the client are complicit in. There's kind of this, slightly sexy thing, but it's also short enough, 5 minutes, that you can have like a whole deal in under, 5 minutes time.
You're able to build so much character in the short amount of time. Do you focus on the small details or does the storytelling just kind of happen? I'm thinking about there are just such great details in a lot of the apartments, and I'm thinking particularly of the episode Helen, mm-hmm. which is about an adult son who lives in an apartment with his sick mother. You sort of see the kind of artwork that they have in the house or the piles of stuff. Just feels very much like a New York apartment. And then he gets these packages coming into the house, and then you realize he's trying on different shirts because he has a crush on the dealer and he just wants to look nice. And it's just so many of the episodes are really funny. So many of them are sweet. And this is this one that's super bittersweet. Could you talk about those details that seem to just say so much about the characters?
That was one of those instances where we kind of cast the apartment and thought to ourselves, we have access to this place and it's so uniquely tiny. How can we make it look even more claustrophobic and small, and who would live there? And I think really that's where the idea came from, was having the space first. And then, of course, we art directed it. I mean, we pulled everything out from the walls to make it look a little smaller. We dug out some things from some thrift shops, and we made some fake art and, stuff like that. I mean, we definitely made it look a lot worse than it usually does. But yeah, that was an instance where the apartment came first.
I want to ask a little bit about casting. Everyone in the series is so great. And mostly it's people I haven't seen before. There are a couple of people I recognize from other shows. For example, Greta Lee, a comedic actress, is in one of the first episodes. She's been on The Amy Schumer Show and The New Girl and other movies. But other than that, I didn't recognize a lot of people. Can you talk about casting the series?
Well, Katya is a casting director. Mm-hmm. That was her entree into the entertainment industry. And she had been meeting actors while casting 30 Rock and other shows for about a decade. But we don't have a traditional audition process, but the thing that could be equated with that is just us hanging out with the person that we'd like to write for. I mean, that's what happened with Dan Stevens. We basically hung out with him a half dozen times before we realized what character would fit best for him.
Let's talk about that episode. Dan Stevens, the British actor who a lot of people would know from playing Matthew on Downton Abbey, he's in one of the episodes, and it's actually the episode Rachel, which you guys just won Writers Guild of America Award for, and congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Could you describe the episode for us a little bit?
Sure. It's about a man named Colin who is a stay-at-home dad. He's a writer. He's a screenwriter, and we allude to the fact he's won an Emmy recently, and now he's in this place where he is stuck. He's got writer's block. He's procrastinating. His wife is working very hard every day. She works for a clothing designer named Rachel Comey, and the wife is the breadwinner, and she is getting increasingly frustrated with her husband, who she realizes is procrastinating. She doesn't know the extent of his procrastination, but the viewer learns that he is just basically sitting around smoking weed all day and trying on dresses and basically cross-dressing in the privacy of his home. And then he
orders weed from the guy and has a long talk with the guy while wearing a dress, which is kind of nerve-wracking for him, but the guy doesn't seem to mind at all.
Well, let's listen to part of that episode, Rachel. In this scene, the client, played by Dan Stevens, has ordered some pot from the guy, and he's let him in, and he's wearing a dress.
Yeah, man. This was a good little read. Thank you so much.
Good. I'm glad you enjoyed it. It's good, isn't it? It's a lot of some good stories in it. I'm glad you liked it.
I mean, I was like, why isn't this guy calling me? I have so many good stories about clients, man. Crazy people.
I bet you do.
Yeah. Okay. Look, man. You're wearing a dress right now. I can't pretend that you're not wearing a dress. You don't usually wear dresses. But you look good.
Oh, thanks, man. Thank you. I appreciate that.
I have another customer who cross-dresses.
Oh, you do?
Very frumpy.
Yeah, the taste in the community can be a bit patchy, you know?
Yeah, his taste sucks. Your taste is... It works, man. I'm like, where's my dress?
Yes. It's Rachel Comey.
That's a scene from the episode Rachel, and that's also the episode that Katya Blickfeld and Ben Sinclair won the Writers Guild of America Award for. Now, Katya, you were in casting for a long time. You're a casting director for the show 30 Rock, and you even won an Emmy for that. 30 Rock is such a great show, and it had this great cast, and it also had guest stars over the seasons, you know, Elaine Stritch,
yes.
Elizabeth Banks, John Hamm. So what does a casting director do, or what did you do as a casting director on that show? Did you have to sort of work on all of those levels?
Oh, for sure. And I mean, I was part of a team. It wasn't just me. But our day-to-day in the casting department was, and this is really what took the most work, I think, was filling all of those sort of lesser roles, those one-scene roles, or those under fives, as we call them in the business. And those were actually, in my experience, even harder to cast, because it's so much easier to present a role that is several scenes, a juicy role to an actor, and especially on a show like that, and get kind of your pick of whoever you want. But when it comes to sort of those smaller roles, there was this standard in place for really great acting and really great comedy, and you couldn't just sort of throw any old person in a scene with Alec Baldwin, even if it is just one line, even if there's no lines. So it really was challenging, I think, week after week to try to find people who would be humble enough to come and just say a line or two, but also fit the role and could sort of hold their own against people like Alec Baldwin, Tina Fey, Jane Krakowski, and sometimes one of those major guest stars.
I want to play a quick clip from 30 Rock, and this episode, it was the 100th episode. Actually, Ben Sinclair, you're in this episode.
Yeah,
you're
Ben's playing, in that one.
You're playing the role of Brooklyn Hipster, and just to give a little background on the scene, for some reason, Tracy Jordan, the character Tracy Jordan, played by Tracy Morgan, is sort of freaking out, or maybe he won an Oscar, and he's trying to get back his dirty image, so he's in the street kind of freaking out, and your character, Ben, the Brooklyn Hipster, reacts to it. Let's take a listen.
I am a Jedi!
Hey, look. Tracy Jordan is ironically reappropriating his bad past behavior as a commentary on Fitzgerald's dictum that there are no second acts in American life. I want to take a picture of him with my old-fashioned camera.
No!
And then he falls in the river. Someone falls in the river. Ben, that's you in 30 Rock. I wanted to ask you, I would think that being an actor in New York City would be so difficult. I was looking at your IMDb profile, and I saw that you were in an episode of Law & Order SVU, and I kind of feel like every actor in New York has to make an appearance in one of the Law & Order spinoffs.
It is a rite of passage. Yes.
So I just think that must be hard.
It was hard, and I didn't get any parts until I met Katya, and she was like, why don't you just let your beard grow?
And act like yourself.
And act like yourself. There is like a headshot of me where I'm wearing like a members only leather jacket and I look like real serious and I'm shaven and my head is shaved and I look like...
Like he's trying to be like a tough guy, leading guy.
Which is total crap because like I am like a guy who is like very not tough at all. I've never been in a physical altercation in my whole life. So it was interesting for me to stop caring about trying to be this person I wasn't and just letting that laid back guy who likes to sit around and smoke pot, to be honest. And that chill guy was able to come out with the beard, but Katya was the one who noticed that I was much better at being this relaxed, open dude who could really talk to anyone. And that's what she says one of her reasons for making High Maintenance was to kind of show that other side of my acting ability.
Well, Katya Blickfeld and Ben Sinclair, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you for having us.
Katya Blickfeld and Ben Sinclair created the web series High Maintenance, which Sinclair stars in. They spoke with Fresh Air producer Anne-Marie Baldonado. Coming up, writer Chris Offutt tells us about growing up with his father, who supported the family by writing pornography. This is Fresh Air Weekend. We're going to listen to Terry's recent interview with Chris Offutt, author of a forthcoming memoir called My Father, the Pornographer, which was excerpted in early February in the New York Times Magazine. Chris Offutt is known for his fiction and literary memoirs. His father was known by 17 pen names, under which he wrote nearly 375 porn books. He also wrote a couple of science fiction books and 24 fantasy novels. His first porn book was published in 1968, and in 1970, he shut down his small insurance agency, thinking porn would be more profitable. The timing was right, with the sexual revolution expanding the market. His readers probably wouldn't have guessed that he wrote from his home in Kentucky, in what Chris Offutt describes as a hill and holler community, a zip code with a creek. While Chris was growing up there, the source of his father's income was a family secret. In 2013, when Chris was 54, his father died and left Chris an inheritance of thousands of letters and tens of thousands of novel pages. Chris moved back to his childhood home for several months to sort the papers and assemble a bibliography. By the way, this interview isn't explicit about porn. It's really about the father.
Chris Offutt, welcome to Fresh Air. You write that your father considered himself the class operator in the field of pornography. What was he known for in the field?
Well, I'm not really sure. There hasn't been a great deal of scholarship on the field of pornography to separate out what one writer was known for with another. Dad believed that he had introduced various anatomical descriptions into pornography that had not been there before. He also believed that he had introduced the fact that a female could derive a great deal of pleasure, then that had not been seen in pornography before. At the same time, it's hard to know if that was true or not. The point, though, is that Dad believed it, and he thought he was a very good writer. And the other reason for that was that he believed that other porn writers were copying his style and some of these pioneering uses of anatomical language regarding sexuality.
So he wrote in so many subgenres of porn. Would you just name a few for us?
Geez, I don't think he left any out. There's ghosts, zombie porn, porn set in Atlantis, porn on alien planets with barbarian cultures, vampire porn in New York City. Another common subgenre was swingers, of course, and then multiple people at once. No telling how many numbers you could get up to there. Science fiction pornography, pirates, and porns of the Old West.
Porn of the Old West, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Who knew?
Well, I found a manuscript. You know, in addition to the 400 books, there were 25 unpublished novels, and one of them was Porn in the Old West that opened in a barn and had a great character named Quiet Smith, one of my favorite names.
So your father initially was selling insurance, and he quit his job to help raise money for things like your orthodontia, your braces. And he became a team with your mother who typed the manuscripts. What a huge shift in the family to go from this like very secure kind of job to writing pornography and having your mother type it? I mean, was she comfortable even reading what he was writing?
Oh, yeah. She was part and parcel from the beginning. He was a successful businessman in sales, but wasn't happy. He'd always written since he was a child and wanted to write. But at age 36, he had four kids and a mortgage. And I needed orthodontic care. And all of my siblings and me were in school. So Mom had suggested that she get a job outside of the home to pay for the dental care. And Dad didn't want to do that. So they just hatched this plan. And in a certain way, it's incredibly courageous for a 36-year-old person in this circumstances he was in to just shut down a successful business and decide to be a writer.
Why pornography? Like, why not Westerns or detective novels or any of the other popular genres?
Well, he had wanted to be a science fiction writer and had begun publishing science fiction in 1954, and that was always been his goal and interest. At a certain point, the markets for science fiction vanished. There was just dozens of these magazines folded, and many of the science fiction writers moved into writing pornography because at the same time, that market was starting to really open up. And then there's also the part that he liked it and was interested in it. He had gotten hold of some porn through the mail and just out of curiosity and read it. And according to my mother, decided that he could write it better because it was so horribly written. And Mom just suggested that he do it. So that's kind of what got started.
The way pornography often works in families is that parents, mm-hmm. if they read pornography, hide it from their children, and the children who read pornography hide it from their parents. Mm-hmm. In your family, your parents were in the porn business. Did they mm-hmm. hide it from you? How old were you when they told you about it?
Oh, it was a secret, of course. It was a secret within the family, within the community. It just was not really talked about. How old was I? I mean, I was probably 12 or 13 when I came across porn in the house. That's not uncommon for many people to be a curious teenager. It took me a couple of years to realize that it seemed like Dad was writing this. But I did not know that Mom was actually typing all of his final manuscripts for submission to the publishers. She could zip through it. I would come home from school, would walk through the woods along a little path, enter the house to the sound of two typewriters simultaneously clattering away. It was an unusual circumstance. But I knew Dad was a writer. I just assumed that it was science fiction.
So how did the conversation in the family get open? Did they tell you about the porn? Or did you confront them with the fact that you suspected that this is what they were
Neither.
Doing?
There was no official formal conversation where this is what we're doing and you should know or anything like that. It was a maintained secret as much as possible. Part of it was just living in a small community and a conservative community in the hills of Kentucky. But it wasn't till I was out of the house and in my 20s that Dad became more forthcoming about his pornographic work. My understanding prior to that had been he was a functioning science fiction writer and the pornography was generating supplemental income. So it wasn't actually until after until I was in my 20s and 30s, I realized it was a much bigger enterprise on his part. And then after his death, I found out that it was lifelong and much larger than I had anticipated.
Your father wrote a lot of the pornography under the pen name John Cleave. Mm-hmm. And you write that he used to talk about John Cleave in the third person, as if it was another person. And that, you know, John Cleave had his own wardrobe, his own stationery, his own signature. Mm-hmm. And John Cleave had 16 pseudonyms. They weren't your father's pseudonyms. They were his pseudonyms. Did your father ever dress as John Cleave around you? Did you ever see that personality manifesting, that alter ego, and think, what's going on?
Yes. I believe that he regarded John Cleave as an alter ego. The John Cleave as an alter ego gave him a great deal of freedom. And I've talked to other writers who use pseudonyms, and there is, even if the writer is still sitting in the same chair, the same typewriter, the same house, the idea that he or she is not writing as who they actually are, but under this literary mask, it offers a little bit of freedom. I think in that case, that was important to Dad. Also, using pseudonyms was a way of protecting identity and, to a certain extent, protecting the family from any sort of scandal or bias towards the kids or, you know, nasty comments. The other pseudonyms that he used were, some of them were for specific genres. Others he would use to conceal his prolificity. He would be publishing with one publisher and then get a contract with another publisher and use a pseudonym to avoid the first publisher knowing that he was working for the competition. Dad right. didn't really care. He just wanted to get food on a table.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Chris Offit, and he has a memoir that will be published next year called My Father, the Pornographer. It was recently excerpted in the New York Times Magazine, and his father wrote over 400 pornography books in every imaginable subgenre. Chris Offit, my guest, has also written books of fiction as well as two other memoirs. To give us more of a sense of what your father wrote, can you name some of the titles of some of his books?
Sure. Be happy to do that. I should also tell you that the book is dedicated to 17 people, all of or 18 people, all Dad and all of his pseudonyms.
That's hysterical.
Yeah. Well, it seemed to make sense. Okay. Well, the first one was called Bondage Babes, and in 1968 he published five: Bondage Babes, Swapper Town, Sex Toy, Gang Swap, and The Seductress. Bruise, which I believe to be his best porn novel. The one that Dad thought was the best was called Mongol with an exclamation point. I've never been he had 12 or 14 books that had exclamation points in the title, so I'm not sure how to pronounce it. Mongol, maybe. Mongol. Fruit of the Loin. The Devoured is Vampires in New York City, not a bad book. I could keep on going. I mean, there's a lot.
So I don't know if any of the stories are radio-friendly that your father told in his fiction, but is there one that would give us a sense of the kind of story that he dreamed up?
Radio-friendly? One that I enjoyed the most, these two couples crash landed on a deserted island, but come to find out the island wasn't deserted. After all, it was just unexplored. The middle of the island had a volcano. On the other side of the volcano lived a primitive culture that would drop virgins into the volcano to sacrifice to the gods for good weather and good luck, right? Now, the other side, where they crash landed, was occupied and inhabited by all the virgins who'd managed to escape from the other side of the volcano. So you can imagine then what went on after the plane landed, crash landed, and everybody survived. It's pretty interesting. Like one of the guys goes native and one of the guys doesn't, and there's some morality in there and great concerns about impacting on this culture that had not been westernized or anything.
Do you think your father was obsessed with sex in real life or just in books?
Well, I don't think there was much distinction between the two. I think that he was obsessed. He described himself as being hypersexual and had been ever since he could remember. And I think that it just found its way into his work and most of what he wrote.
Did you ever get a chance to really talk with him about that?
About what?
How obsessed he was with writing pornography?
Well, talking with Dad was often a case of listening to Dad talk about what he wanted to talk about. But it was something that he did talk to me about. I think that he became more open about it with me once I started writing and publishing myself. He realized that we could have a relationship as a writer to writer because our father-son relationship was quite strained. It was important to him that someone have some idea of the extent of his output.
Do you think that you grew up with this sense of secrets, you know, and that maybe even though you didn't know that the secrets pertained to sex and pornography, that you somehow picked up on that anyways? I mean, I guess I'm wondering what impact it had on you to grow up with all this secrecy, mm-hmm. and especially since the secrets had to do with writing about sex.
Yes, there was an element of secrecy to it that I grew up with. I don't know what the impact would have been. I mean, Dad was, he was obsessed with sex, and he would talk about it, but obliquely, you know. He would often make jokes in a sort of a naughty style of comments and all. But there was still a pall of secrecy that hung over the house that that we all, you know, felt, or at least certainly I did. So as far as the impact, I'm not really sure, you know, other than it could have motivated me to write memoir, for example, which is the opposite of a pseudonymous secret writing.
Oh, that's
life.
True. That's a really good point. And I wonder how you feel about this forthcoming memoir about your father, because you will be exposing all the secrets he kept throughout his life, all the pseudonyms that he wrote under, everything that he hid from his family and from his neighbors.
Mm-hmm. How will I feel about it?
Yeah. Does it worry you that maybe your father would be upset, or do you think your father would be happy that finally it can be revealed what a genius he was? You know, because I know he saw himself that way.
There was a part of me when I worked on it that, I mean, I worked on it pretty hard for a couple of years. And at times I would be concerned that I was betraying the big family secret. And I would talk to my siblings about it, and I talked to my mother about it, and, you know, they all pointed out the obvious, which was Dad's dead and you can't betray him. So I don't have any great concerns along those lines. As Mom said the other night, he would have loved the attention. Mm-hmm. And he liked attention. But there was some part of him that did not want to fully reveal the extent of this, of his output and his interest while he was alive. He started out as in sales for Procter & Gamble, traveling salesman to little country stores with Procter & Gamble products, then moved into selling health and life insurance. So sales relies on a great deal of self-belief. And I think that Dad incorporated that into his writing life. I don't know that I've met anyone else who believed in himself as much as Dad did. And Dad fervently and absolutely believed that after he was dead, in the 21st century, he would be well-known and extremely famous for the pornography that he wrote under the name John Cleave. So to answer the question, how would he feel about it? Yes, you know, in a way, this book, to a certain extent, is fulfilling his own prophecy that he made about his legacy in the world. If it's true, I don't know if it'll be wind up true or not, but he would really have enjoyed it, yes.
Chris Offutt's forthcoming memoir is called My Father, the Pornographer. You'll find a much longer version of his conversation with Terry online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Cheam, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.